Hi, everyone. What follows is a series of shows that was inspired by recent current events involving the NSA, PRISM, Edward Snowden. I'm going to assume that you have some prior knowledge of these stories. And, of course, the mainstream media reaction, not a unanimous reaction, I'm happy to say, but certainly the majority, asking very leading questions about what kind of power the government has legally, of course, legally, to deal with people who reveal these important truths. And at the same time, stressing the illegality and the precedence for the illegality of revealing such important information to the public. So this is a historical survey. It is certainly not a complete history of how, in the 20th century, the telling of the most important and complete truths in the most wide open arena became a criminal activity. It will also ask the question, were the quote-unquote enemies of America in the 20th century all really that clever? Because it seems that every time a new enemy was presented to the public, said, okay, everyone, you're going to have to sacrifice some liberties, some money, maybe your lives. Everyone, shoulders to the wheel to fight this new threat. Well, in the short run, and in some cases the long run, the American public and the political culture seem to absorb many of the worst attributes of that enemy. The Central Powers, the Soviets, the Third Reich, the Soviets again, Islamic fundamentalism, the great culmination of the U.S. foreign policy in the 20th century, and the ideal example of what I'm talking about here, a war against terrorism, fought with terrorism. Was it an organized long-term conspiracy involving all of America's enemies? Or are lazy minds just easy prey for these simplistic, often very emotionally attractive ideas? Or does the truth lie somewhere in between? We shall see. I hope you enjoy this.
And let me just say one other thing. More broadly speaking, what the NSA is, we are putting trillions of dollars into developing extremely sophisticated technology. The idea, the objective of this is to enable the NSA to monitor every single conversation and every single form of human behavior anywhere in the world. And if that is something that we want our government to be doing, we should have an open debate about that, not have it done in secret.
An incredibly important question that affects all of us. If we have to put it in your perspective. I want to bring Richard Haass in, but quickly, I just want an answer yes or no. Isn't it the case that reviewing of emails or any wiretapping cannot take place without an additional warrant from a judge and a review? I mean, it's not like there's haphazard probing into all of our personal emails. Can we put this into context so we understand exactly what's going on?
Yeah, I'll put it into context for you. The White House talking points that you're using are completely misleading and false.
Damage control in high gear. It's far from over for the U.S. after WikiLeaks releases thousands of secret U.S. documents. Today, President Obama is attempting to mend fences with key allies, Turkey and Mexico. And now a new and similar whistleblowing website is reportedly set to launch tomorrow. It's not WikiLeaks. It's called OpenLeaks. So what is our government doing to protect our secrets and stop these websites from revealing them? Let's bring in the ranking member of the Homeland Security Committee, Congressman Peter King of New York, who soon in the new year will be the chairman of that committee. The more I read about what our options are, particularly about the Espionage Act, which dates back to 1917, if I have it right, if we could use these laws against Julian Assange, if we could even get jurisdiction over him here in the United States when he isn't located here, he's in the UK, that's where he's being held on rape charges. He could be executed if, in fact, these laws could be utilized for what he's done. But it's more difficult than that. Why is it so difficult? That act has never really been effectively used. Why haven't we changed it?
It probably should have been updated several years ago. But having said that, Jamie, I still think that the law as written should be applied by the Justice Department. The Justice Department should prosecute him under the Espionage Act. Because even though he's overseas, this to me is an extraditable crime. Violation of the Espionage Act. And so we should go ahead, begin the prosecution, let him raise his defenses. But I think that under the language of the statute, He is subject to indictment, and I think ultimately to a conviction. And
but he's going to argue, Congressman, he'll argue freedom of speech. He'll argue too much information by the U.S. is classified. It's good that some of this information comes out. And there are some people that will agree with him. The Justice Department is taking it under advisement. But every day that goes by, what's at stake?
Each day that goes by, more and more secrets come out, and our position around the world gets weakened. But I don't think this is a freedom of speech issue. I mean, freedom of speech is not absolute. Otherwise, we wouldn't have libel or slander laws. And even under the Pentagon Papers case, the Supreme Court said that maybe you can't stop a newspaper from releasing the information, but you can still prosecute them for espionage after the fact. Because if we don't take action here, this is going to go on. And in the cyber age, you're going to see more and more of it, and we can't allow ourselves to be defenseless against someone like Assange and WikiLeaks.
Can your committee do anything that the president isn't?
We are certainly going to have hearings, and we're going to put as much pressure on as we can. And I'm hoping that behind the scenes, Eric Holt is doing more than he's let on.
Yeah, let's talk about the NSA and the comprehensive program now with PRISM and everything being out there and being examined. We're discussing the breadth of the NSA program. You are a take no prisoners person when it comes to the war on terror. How do you feel about it?
Look, show me one American, one law-abiding American citizen who has been hurt by any of these NSA programs.
None,
exactly. They're keeping us safe. You know, if the intel community backs off and doesn't do this stuff and there's a terrorist attack, then it's intelligence failure. If they do this stuff, well, it's Big Brother snooping. And now you've got this 29-year-old high school dropout whistleblower making foreign policy for our country, our security policy. And the guy, look, I think it's sad, Brian, we've made treason cool. Betraying your country is kind of a fashion statement. He wants to be the national security Kim Kardashian. He cites Bradley Manning as a hero. I mean, we need to get very, very serious about treason. And oh, by the way, for treason, as in the case of Bradley Manning or Edward Snowden, you bring back the death penalty.
Americans, they're doing that too, and the NSA keeps saying, and it's false, they can't provide those numbers. So those talking points that you're reading from are completely false, as anybody who's paid even remote attention to the surveillance debates know over the last 10 years.
Glenn, I'd like to ask a question. Is this legal or illegal? Or Richard Haass, can you help me out here since Glenn doesn't want to answer the question? Is the law being broken here?
I did answer your question.
I question the law. I question all the issues that this raises. I'm personally concerned as well, but I'd like to put this in perspective. Is the law being broken?
The law was broken by one person, who was Mr. Snowden. Now, you might think the law is unwise. You may think the policy is unwise. And if that's the case, there are mechanisms for challenging it.
But so far, I'm not scared. So far, I haven't heard a single thing about what the government has collected on me that isn't also collected by a bunch of private companies. And the fact that the government is collecting it at such a gigantic, massive level means that it's even harder for the government to find me in this giant amount of data that they have. And they have absolutely no incentive to find me. And so I at this stage, feel completely unthreatened by this.
We don't know who's a terrorist. We had no idea of the subway bomber, apparently. This is somebody who was apprehended before he attacked in New York City. And we would have had images like the Boston images. Dead people, injured people, relatives wailing and crying. And that was averted by a program.
Guest writes, Krauthammer's police analogy is flawed. It was made earlier. To make it applicable here, the police would be shooting everyone and asserting that some of them are or could be in the future criminals.
Bulletproof vest.
Well, that would cut down on crime.
We have a history in this country that we can look to. Go and look at the Church Committee report of the mid-1970s, with which I know that you're obviously familiar. And what it found is that when you empower politicians and law enforcement officials to gather massive amounts of information about people and don't provide sufficient transparency and oversight to how they're using it, they will abuse it. It's J. Edgar Hoover's FBI followed Martin Luther King around, read his mail, listened to his conversations, found out about what they thought were adulterous relationships, and tried to use it to discredit him and even encourage him to commit suicide. What he's trying to say is that we should be debating whether we want to have a government that is in the business of collecting huge amounts of extremely invasive information about not terrorists or people suspected of wrongdoing, but all Americans, and think about the potential for abuse that has, the inevitability of abuse that has. And even if you're right, Lawrence, at the end of the day that we decide we do want that, at the very least, we should have way more transparency and checks and accountability on how this is done and what is being done, which is the reason that we decided to write these stories, so that we could start a debate and make Americans aware of what this apparatus is actually doing.
Yeah, I mean, Glenn, my feeling so far is in everything, and I've been slow to react to it because I want to take in as much as possible. But so far, I'm not scared.
So as I tried to make sense of all of this, Glenn Greenwald, very smart guy, guy I have a lot of respect for, encourages Lawrence O'Donnell. It's kind of a futile encouragement to, along with the MSNBC viewers, to look at history, right? Because here's another discussion about a very important topic going on in the mainstream media in a complete, not only a moral and logical vacuum, but also a historical vacuum. So if it's insane to think that a program like this could ever get out of control, there's oversight, right? Now, there is, on paper, oversight that involves all three branches of government, of course. Right. So President Obama can get up and speak about this NSA program. If we just want to talk about prison and say, oh, yeah, all three branches of government have signed off on this. The executive branch is communicating with Congress about this, which is not really true. The executive branch might be sharing some information with the Intelligence Committee in Congress, which is eight people. And then they cannot talk about what is shared. So we're sharing information with Congress is like a very clever thing to say, but this is all bullshit anyway, right? Because it doesn't matter if branches of government are sharing things with each other, and we call that checks and balances. When did we learn that? Sixth grade civics? We should have been over that. We should have known how full of holes that was by the time we were in eighth grade. So I think we should look at history, because it's very frustrating to listen to people in the mainstream media try to repackage this as something new that isn't out of control yet, right? Lawrence O'Donnell, oh, I'm not terribly worried about this, you know? This represents something that's over 30 years old that's out of control already. The FISA legislation passed in 1978 and looked, I guess, at the time, I mean, maybe there was opposition at the time. I couldn't find any. To be pretty non-threatening, because it was really specific about how warrants would only be given out for gathering foreign intelligence, not domestic intelligence, not intelligence against American citizens. In 2008, it was amended. This is going to be a recurring theme on today's show. So it was amended to provide, a little more wiggle room for those who were seeking these warrants. And ultimately, we find out that the FISA courts are essentially just a rubber stamping agency for any request, basically. And there has been some probing into, well, what requests are denied? And there's very little evidence that any are denied. And the more I tried to process all of this, the more I tried to come up with a coherent presentation for you folks as well, I kept thinking of G. Edward Griffin. Many of you might be familiar with his work. He is the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, about the origins of the Federal Reserve. But he also, there's this video on YouTube you can go and grab, and I used a good portion of this in a past show, actually, about the Nazis, called The Collectivist Conspiracy. Today, I think we look at periods in American history, during World War I, the clear and present danger test, the Espionage Act, shamefully invoked again and again, something people want used against Bradley Manning and now Snowden and a handful of others, some journalists, the Red Scare, McCarthyism. And we can look back at that as paranoid, silly, fascist. But there was a real threat. And as Griffin points out, didn't those kinds of ideas, those collectivist communist ideas that all of these really draconian operations and programs were set up, at least if you take their word for it, people in government and the apologists, academics and historians, they were set up to prevent these things. Well, you know, apparently those threats were real. you know, the big warnings about communism in the 80s, all these terrible things that happened in the Soviet Union. Almost everything, I pointed this out before too, almost every horror story we're told about Nazi Germany, aside from the camps and the gas chambers, happens here today. So the idea of collectivism won. And it doesn't mean that there should be like exculpation for the people who set up these programs, or passed this legislation, the Espionage Act, the Palmer Raids, HUAC, all that stuff. But if we look at the state in which we currently live and the pervasive ideas, that paranoia apparently was justified. So I found this interesting article that I wanted to share with you. The title really caught my eye, right? It's actually from Slate. And the title of this piece is The Hidden History of the Espionage Act. The slug, the much maligned 1917 law had a real purpose, stopping spies and saboteurs, by David Greenberg. On July 24th, 1915, the World War was raging in Europe, and the belligerents were vying for the sympathy of the neutral United States. In Lower Manhattan, on a 6th Avenue elevated train, Secret Service agents were tailing George Sylvester Viereck, a German propagandist and a mysterious companion of his who was, unbeknown to the agents, Heinrich F. Albert, an attaché in the German embassy. When Viereck got off the 23rd Street, one agent followed him. Albert continued to 50th Street, where he suddenly looked up from his newspaper and noticed he had reached his stop, and hurried off the car, leaving behind a brown briefcase that the second agent promptly seized. A chase ensued, but the purloined bag ultimately made it to Treasury Secretary William McAdoo, who shared it with President Woodrow Wilson. The documents that Wilson and McAdoo beheld detailed a sweeping secret campaign linked to high-ranking German officials of espionage, sabotage, and propaganda. There were plans to take over American newspapers, bankroll films, send hired lecturers on the Chautauqua circuit, and create pseudo-indigenous movements to agitate on behalf of pro-German policies. More disturbingly were schemes to provoke strikes in armaments factories, to corner the supply of liquid chlorine, an ingredient in poison gas, in order to keep it from Allied hands, even to acquire the Wright Brothers Aeroplane Company and use its patents on Germany's behalf. American officials also learned of sabotage plans hatched by a different German spy, Franz Rettlin von Kleist, who was plotting to destroy American munitions plants and blow up the Welland Canal, Canadian waterway of virtual importance to the United States. It was no wonder that Wilson wrote to his advisor, Edward House, that summer that the country was, quote, honeycombed with German intrigue and infested with German spies. Although these plots are omitted from most discussions of the 1917 Espionage Act, the law, now being invoked by those who would prosecute WikiLeaks mastermind Julian Assange, they go a long way toward explaining, but not excusing, that unfortunate piece of wartime legislation. When Wilson made the case for entering the World War, he warned that, quote, if there should be disloyalty, it will be dealt with a firm hand of stern repression, unquote. Contrary to some interpretations, the president wasn't perversely touting his intention to trample civil liberties. He was grimly cautioning would-be saboteurs, like those who had blown up the supply depot at Black Tom, New Jersey, the year before, not to undermine the combat effort. The Espionage Act had a legitimate purpose, to try to stop the real threat of subversion, sabotage, and malicious interference with the war effort, including the controversial reinstatement of the draft. Its context that's worth recalling as Democrats and Republicans alike clamor to use the law against Assange. On April 6, 1917, Congress declared war on Germany, and for the next 9 weeks it was engaged in robust, contentious debate about the proper scope of an espionage bill. Some elements were struck from the first drafts. Originally, the White House wanted to censor the press, but Congress, reflecting fierce resistance in the newspapers, killed a provision. A provision to let the Postmaster General regulate the mails remained, but it was narrowed to restrict suppressible materials to those urging treason or lawbreaking that would hinder the war effort. A ban on efforts to cause disaffection in the military was replaced with a more closely tailored prohibition on efforts to cause insubordination, mutiny, or disloyalty. That last word used, as it was in Wilson's speech, to mean disloyal action, not private sentiment. Overall, the act wasn't meant, as it has often been represented, to stifle anti-war dissent, but to address particular wartime problems that officials had good reason to worry about: draft avoidance, sabotage, and espionage. Well, folks, how nice and apologetic that is to the Woodrow Wilson administration. Okay? Now, I don't think that the author is entirely going to let them and the Espionage Act off the hook here. But we have to remember some of the people that Wilson surrounded himself with. Okay? Now, Bernays is helping Wilson craft a digestible message for the stupid American public about why war is good. That's one thing. But his chief advisor, as the article actually mentioned, was a guy named Colonel Edward Mendel House. Not a real colonel. He just liked the title. Who was very, very into the idea of centralizing power, centralizing control, one world government, and actually wrote a book called Philip Drew Administrator, where the protagonist, a take-charge executive kind of guy, creates a central bank, graduated income tax to basically fund that central bank, and then makes some pretty significant moves towards world government. Coincidentally, perhaps, all things that happened during the administration of the president that he was advising. So, the more I learned about House, the more I felt bad for criticizing Wilson. Wilson was an academic. He had been the president of Princeton, I think, and he was really naive. And maybe his intentions were good. And as a lot of these other clowns who came along in the next 100 years, people creep into the halls of power and they hide in the shadows and they say, hey, listen to me, you dimwit. I'm the expert here. Saw plenty of that during the Reagan administration, the Bush administration. I'm pretty sure that that's what's going on to a certain extent during the Obama administration. Everybody thinks Wilson at that time is naive. I mean, when he goes to, you know, negotiate the Treaty of Versailles, the French think he's a fool. How idealistic he is coming from America that isn't war-torn like Europe is, that something like the 14 points would actually work. It didn't work. It didn't work. But if you think about that story that article opens with about this German plot, and the Germans were plotters, I'll tell you. Okay, we talk about the Zimmerman telegram. I mean, their attempts at sabotage and espionage were pretty sophisticated during the First World War. So there are some legitimate concerns regarding German spying at this time. But there's more to the story.
And for a little more elaboration on the whole Wilson House advisor-president relationship, there's a question of how much advising is going on. Does Wilson go to House and say, hey, Ed, got an idea. Let's spitball this. Or is House, a man who operates completely in the shadows, who is mentioned in not one secondary American history text that I've ever seen, anyway, delivering to Wilson, who is very naive and apparently quite impressionable, plans that he has fully formed on his own or with some other secretive group? Here's an example. And I want you to listen closely and see if what House is suggesting here in 1918 sounds like the seeds of an organization or a couple of organizations that many of us are familiar with today. On November 12th, 1918, Woodrow Wilson receives a letter from Edward House, from Paris, It reads, number 99, secret for the president, referring further to our number 61. I beg to suggest the following. The whole problem of securing political intelligence, establishing an adequate counter-espionage organization, and providing protection for you and for the personnel, papers, and property of the American representatives at the peace conference should be dealt with, I believe, along the following lines. Number one, political intelligence. At the present time, the United States officials in Europe charged with considering political and economic questions presented by the termination of the war are receiving practically no dependable information concerning political and economic conditions in the following countries: Poland, Bohemia, Ukraine, Austria, Serbia, including Yugoslavia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Albania, and Turkey. From Romania and Greece, some information is obtained, but it is very incomplete. I consider it essential that we at once set up instrumentalities in these localities, which will furnish us with information concerning political conditions in these countries, and that this information concerning political conditions in these countries should come to us through American eyes. I do not think it would be difficult promptly to set up an organization for this purpose, and I suggest that I be authorized to proceed along the following lines. A. After conferring with Hoover, hold that thought, and learning of his plans for relief to select men from among the United States military and naval forces now in Europe and from any other available sources, who shall be appointed for the time being agents of the Department of State. These men to constitute the basis of a political intelligence section of the American delegation to the peace conference. B. To dispatch the men so selected as soon as practicable to do so to points such as Warsaw, Lemberg, Posen, Prague, Bem, Budapest, Kiev, Sarajevo, Skhetari, Constantinople, and Odessa. One agent should be sent to each place and should take with him one code clerk with codes, one stenographer, and if necessary, one interpreter. A courier service will also shortly have to be established to operate between the United States and individual agents and their base from which messages could be forwarded by telegraph to Paris. C. These agents so selected not to be, in any sense, accredited to the countries in which they are located. The military and naval men, of course, will not wear uniforms. So as far as possible, the governments in these localities to which they are sent will be requested to give them assistance in the conduct of their work. These men would work in close cooperation with any relief set up by Hoover. D. To set up, at some point in the Balkans, such as possibly Bucharest, a central office to which these agents can forward, probably for the president, by courier only, their reports for transmission to the United States via Paris. E. To establish at Paris, for the assistance of the American delegation at the peace conference, a political intelligence section, under the direction of GRU and such other persons as the State Department may send to help him, to which would be forwarded all reports from these agents and from other agents of the Department of State already constituted in European countries. Part 2. Counter-espionage organization. I have conferred with General Nolan, the head of the United States military intelligence in Europe, and I believe that this work should be handed over to him, and I suggest that a civil official of the Department of State who has an appreciation of the duty of work desired done should be associated with him. 3. The protection of the president and of the American delegation at the peace conference and their papers and property. I suggest that the most practical method of handling this problem is through the use of military authorities working under the direction of General Nolan, who is entirely familiar with the peculiar conditions presented by this kind of work in France. Almost all of the personnel to do this work outlined in paragraph 1 can be obtained here in Europe. I should very much appreciate an expression of your views respecting this important matter. If the plan as outlined is promptly approved, it can be put into operation before the peace conference is called. Edward House.
Now, some of you might be saying, that's not terribly controversial. He's an advisor. But what House is introducing here, in my estimation, is the prototype, the blueprints of what could become some of the intelligence agencies that we see today, or even project that he worked on after he left the Wilson administration, the Council on Foreign Relations. And it was a wonderful achievement for House to get to a point where he could advise Wilson in such great detail about such a bold undertaking, a world web of geopolitical planning and intelligence gathering, a construct, an instrumentality, if you will, that would be far less valuable in a peaceful world. But who was House? There is a book that I would recommend called Woodrow Wilson's Right Hand, The Life of Colonel Edward M. House, written by Godfrey Hodgson. But there's also a piece on lewrockwell.com written by Robert Higgs that summarizes some of Hodgson's findings. I want to share some of that with you before we move on. In 1911, he, House, spied what he took to be a potentially rising star to which he might hitch his idle political wagon, a man with no prior experience as a politician until his election as governor of New Jersey in November 1910. Woodrow Wilson had been, except for a brief stint as a fledgling lawyer, a lifelong academic. He spent his life prior to 1910 as a student, professor, and university administrator, serving from 1902 to 1910 as the president of Princeton University, an office in which he gained a well-deserved reputation for his self-righteous refusal to compromise. After Wilson's election as governor, a number of Democrats began to tout him as the party's next candidate for the presidency, and in the winter of 1910 to 1911, House decided to join his movement to, quote, do what I could to further Governor Wilson's fortunes. House played an important role as campaign strategist and intra-party peacemaker in 1911 and 1912, and he deserves part of the credit for getting Wilson first the nomination and then the presidency. Of course, the principal person responsible for Wilson's election was Theodore Roosevelt, whose insatiable craving for power had led him to bolt the Republican Party and run as a Progressive Party Bull Moose candidate, thereby splitting the opposition to Wilson and ensuring a Democratic victory. House played a more important role after Wilson's election, because the president-elect had little interest in the nuts and bolts of party politics, including the distribution of patronage and the selection of men for cabinet and other high-level positions. And he left these decisions largely in House's hands. Wilson offered House himself any cabinet position he wanted, except Secretary of State, which had been reserved for William Jennings Bryan. But House declined, preferring to work in the shadows as the president's most trusted advisor. Now, for the sake of time here, I want to skip ahead a little bit. Higgs goes on for several paragraphs to talk about House's role in the Wilson administration and a lot of his backroom kind of dealings leading up to the war, during the war. But ultimately, we come to the armistice and the peace conference at Versailles. Once the United States became a declared belligerent, the prospect of an Allied victory increased greatly, and House occupied himself actively not only engineering a way to end the fighting, but also in planning the contours of the post-war world. Like Wilson, House believed, quote, that the war had been imposed on the people of Europe by the monarchies and their aristocracies, unquote. Therefore, both men maintained that a post-war settlement should include, among other things, the destruction of the German and Austro-Hungarian empires and the creation of a number of new democratic states in Central Europe. To fill in the details of this vision, Wilson asked House to assemble a group of experts. The resulting project was known as the Inquiry. The plan it created became the basis for Wilson's 14 points and for his principal proposals at the Versailles Conference. The Inquiry ultimately placed 126 scholars on its payroll. Although each of them had substantial credentials, hardly any of them was an expert on European politics, a shortcoming that helped to doom the president's dealings with the likes of David Lloyd George at Versailles. Skipping ahead again, is it any wonder, then, that the arrangements made at Versailles for the Middle East proved to be the source of what has aptly been called a peace to end all peace, and that almost a century later, the world continues to pay a horrible price for the statesman's bungling in 1919. House contributed probably more than anyone else to the formulation of Wilson's 14 points. This was Wilson's peace plan after World War I, which served as the understanding that led the Germans to silence their guns in November of 1918. On the night of January 5th, 1918, House and Wilson sat down together at 10:30 to sketch out a major speech by Wilson on his vision of a post-war settlement. 2 hours later, they had, as House wrote in his diary, quote, finished remaking the map of the world. When Wilson delivered his speech, however, he, according to Hodgson, conspicuously ignored complexities the inquiry had recognized. Of course, politicians always ignore complexities. If they didn't, they wouldn't last long as politicians. Later, after the Treaty of Versailles had been hammered out, and Wilson's amateurish attempt at direct diplomacy hammered pretty severely in the process, the Germans justly complained that they had been hoodwinked into armistice by Wilson's promise to make the 14 points the basis of a post-war settlement. As Englishman Harold Nicholson wrote, quote, it is difficult to resist the impression that the enemy powers accepted the 14 points as they stood, whereas the Allied powers accepted them only as interpreted by Colonel House. Somewhere, amid the hurried and anxious imprecisions of those October days, lurks the explanation of the fundamental misunderstanding which has since arisen. Unquote. And what a momentous misunderstanding it was. Even James Brown Scott, a legal expert in the U.S. delegation, said of the ultimate treaty that, quote, the statesmen have made a peace that renders another war inevitable, unquote. In light of this history, we might credit House with having an important contribution to ending the fighting in 1918 and to establishing the preconditions for its resumption in 1939. When Wilson departed France in mid-February 1919, he left House at the conference, quote, to act in his place with his full confidence. In the president's absence, House proceeded to do what he had been doing successfully for decades. He made deals, compromising where necessary to gain the other party's agreement and creating the best possible arrangements he could make in an extremely complex and challenging situation. Although House kept Wilson informed as he went along, the president seems not to have fully comprehended what House was agreeing to in France. When he returned to Versailles in mid-March and absorbed the details, he acted with dismay to what he viewed as the betrayal of his high ideals for the settlement. Although House continued to negotiate specific matters at Versailles, he never again acted as the chief U.S. delegate, and the intimate relationship between House and Wilson quickly dissolved. As Hodgson writes, quote, their friendship never recovered from the events of February and March 1919. It ended in bitterness and mutual incomprehension, with grave consequences for both of them ultimately. It really is no exaggeration to say for the peace of the world, unquote. After the Germans signed the treaty in June, House saw the president off for his return voyage to their United States. Their conversation on that occasion was the last they would ever have. Now, from my research, there's another aspect to the story that Higgs, in the piece on LouRockwell.com, doesn't really mention. I mean, maybe he mentions it quickly, tangentially, about some of House's other associations. But he does make a note of the fact that House's dealings in Paris in the late 19-teens were very important for setting the preconditions of World War II. Yet no American history textbook used at the middle school level or secondary level that I've ever seen and I've looked will mention his name. When we look at some of his other associations, the establishment of the Council on Foreign Relations, his interest in developing these kinds of very secretive intelligence services, his interest in moving towards world government, his hand in setting up a central bank in the United States, his associations with people like J.P. Morgan and the Rockefellers. Is it possible that House, people like House, want international conflict? People like House and the people that he serves benefit from wars? Absolutely. You might hear a saying, I think I heard it once or twice on television, regarding the Edward Snowden situation happening currently. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. But when you have impressionable men like Wilson, only interested in political power, whether it be for the power itself or the perks, or perhaps in Wilson's case, the fantasy of some great legacy that he was going to create for himself, guided by somebody like Edward Mendel House. American history provides countless examples of these relationships. These relationships, folks, are going on in the White House right now. Silly little idealistic or power-hungry politicians and people like House who always gravitate to that power and to the ears of those impressionable men to get real things done. Completely unelected, completely unknown to the public. That, and pardon the expression, unholy alliance between these silly politicians who want power and their new friends who know how to use it. Well, the outcome of an increasingly powerful and increasingly secretive government seems very, very predictable. What was the phrase that Higgs used? House didn't want a prestigious position in the Wilson administration. He preferred to work in the shadows. More on that to come later in today's show. So a little background on the Espionage Act, passed in 1917, along with the Trading with the Enemy Act. And this was just months after the United States entered World War I. It was loosely based on something called the Defense Secrets Act of 1911, and was originally based on a piece of British legislation called the Official Secrets Act. And the goal of the Espionage Act was to stiffen the penalties of the 1911 legislation, the Defense Secrets Act. Woodrow Wilson said in his State of the Union address, December 7th, 1915, as he was pushing for this, quote, "There are citizens of the United States who have poured the poison of disloyalty into the very arteries of our national lives. Those who sought to bring the authority and good name of our government into contempt, to destroy our industries, to debase our politics, to the uses of foreign intrigue. We are without adequate federal laws. I am urging you to do nothing less than save the honor and self-respect of the nation. Such creatures of passion, disloyalty, and anarchy must be crushed out." Unquote. So this was something that I think was in process as far as getting legislation through for over a year. There are many members of Congress who were very stubborn about passing such a piece of legislation. The critics thought that it gave the president of the United States basically unlimited power. Wilson wanted as a provision in this bill basically the ability to control or silence the press. Now, whether Wilson really wanted that or not, when we, again, you know, we have to keep focusing on who's operating in the background of the Woodrow Wilson administration. But that was something that came from the White House. Critics also argued that it put firmly in place a system of prior restraint. If you're unfamiliar with that as a legal term, prior restraint is censorship imposed usually by a government on expression before the expression actually takes place. An alternative to prior restraint is to allow the expression to take place and then take appropriate action afterward if the expression is found to violate the law, regulations, or other rules. Prior restraint prevents the censored material from being heard or distributed at all. Other measures provide sanctions only after the offending material has been communicated, such as suits for slander or libel. In some countries, this, according to Wikipedia, for example, the United States and Argentina, prior restraint by the government is forbidden, subject to certain exceptions by a constitution. Prior restraint can be affected in a number of ways. For example, the exhibition of works of art or a movie may require a license from a government authority, sometimes referred to as a classification board or censorship board, before it can be published. And a failure or refusal to grant a license is a form of censorship, as is revoking the license. It can also take the form of a legal injunction or government order prohibiting the publication of a specific document or subject. Sometimes a government or other party becomes aware of a forthcoming publication on a particular subject and seeks to prevent it, to halt ongoing publication and prevent its resumption. These injunctions are considered prior restraint because potential future publications are stopped in advance. I want to read one more section from this Wikipedia article. Exceptions to restrictions on prior restraint. Not all restrictions on free speech are a breach of prior restraint doctrine. It is widely accepted that publication of information affecting national security, particularly in wartime, may be restricted even when there are laws that protect freedom of expression. In many cases, invocation of national security is controversial, with opponents of suppression arguing that the government errors and embarrassment are being covered up. Actually, I will link to this in the show notes, because there are a list of examples in this article that we are not going to get into here. But so, lesson is, as far as prior restraint is concerned, if you're a government, it's ideal if you can always be at war. Very helpful if you want to have de facto prior restraint. So now, let's give the Woodrow Wilson administration the benefit of the doubt, which is a rule of thumb you should never do, but for the sake of argument, we're going to try it here. And let's talk implementation. And one of the reasons why this becomes so problematic so quickly, the power to use the Espionage Act ultimately lies in the hands of local United States attorneys. So really, you have no consistency. With no consistency, you have no predictability. With no predictability, you have great insecurity. And during this time, this legislation, much as similar pieces of legislation are having today, there is a real chilling effect on especially the media, but also public discourse, especially if that discourse is related to opposition to the United States foreign policy. Which, of course, then in 1918 and right up to the present day and for always, is to make the world safe for democracy. Now, I'm going to skip over some stuff that I'm going to come back to. All right. But when World War I ends, the most draconian aspect of this entire piece of legislation, which is called the Sedition Act, is repealed. It ends with the war, if you can believe such a thing. They used to get rid of laws, I guess, at one time. Now, the Sedition Act was probably the most controversial part of the whole Espionage Act. And it was actually kind of like a set of amendments that were added almost a year later. And when most people today talk about the Espionage Act, what they're really talking about, to be completely fair to all of these megalomaniacs operating in the shadows or behind the protection of the government, what they're really talking about is the Sedition Act, something that was actually repealed at the end of World War I. So the Espionage Act, which has been invoked several times to use against Manning and Assange and now Snowden, doesn't do what the Sedition Act did. The Sedition Act, like I said, was a set of amendments that really broadened the range of punishable offenses to speech or somebody expressing some kind of opinion that could publicly expressed. So this is now total prior restraint. Undermine the U.S. government's efforts in World War I. So remember that World War I is actually taking place during a historical period called the Progressive era. It's about from the year 1900 to, say, 1920-ish, prior to the Roaring Twenties. It is the era of basically Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. So in this time, we see in the United States a tremendous growth, not just in the size, but also in the power of unions. And some of these unions are, you know, very non-threatening to the status quo. For example, the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, which was actually founded 20 years before the Progressive Era even starts, but really grows during this time. It's conservative. It's exclusionary. They really don't have major problems with industrial capitalism. They do want to tweak it and get more out of it for themselves, but not really revolutionary in any sense. At the time the United States entered World War I, they have about 4 million members nationwide. And just as a, you know, a postscript, in the 1950s, they join up with the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and that's where we get the AFL-CIO today. There's another union, though, that's very different from the AFL. And it is called the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. They are nicknamed the Wobblies. I don't know why. Now, they're small compared to the AFL. At their peak, they have maybe 150,000 people. And they are not conservative. They want a major overhaul of the entire system. Helen Keller was also a member of the IWW. So if you happen to be playing Trivial Pursuit while listening to this podcast and that comes up, you're welcome. In an effort to gain political power, they team up with something called the American Socialist Party, which I think today is known as the Republican and Democratic parties. Could be wrong. Could be wrong. But in an effort to change the system, they know they have to attach themselves to political power. Now, these are not Germans, first of all. They're not even Soviets. That ain't even really a thing yet. But they are radical. A candidate comes out of the American Socialist Party. His name is Eugene Debs, and he ran for president, like, I think 4 times, 4 consecutive times going back to like the 1900s. So Debs, because of his attachment and a couple other things, is, you know, labeled a radical. And in the backdrop of World War I and the Espionage Act, and really, to be completely accurate, the Sedition Act of 1918, he gives a speech at one point where he encourages people to not participate in the conscription process, kind of indirectly. He says some things that aren't like super pro-draft, and he's arrested and he's thrown in jail. Now, there's a couple of things that I think are worth pointing out right here. First of all, a term, I don't know if I've ever used this on the show or not. We've certainly talked about the idea, mission creep. Again, from Wikipedia, today's show brought to you by Wikipedia. Mission creep is the expansion of a project or mission beyond its original goals, often after initial successes, but not always, I'm adding that. Mission creep is usually considered undesirable due to the dangerous path of each success breeding more ambitious attempts, only stopping when a final, often catastrophic failure occurs. The term was originally applied exclusively to military operations, but has recently been applied to many different fields. And in my opinion, I think it is totally fine to apply it retroactively. In this case here, when we're talking about the Espionage Act. Because, well, Eugene Debs, if you go back to Wilson's original stated goals, that the writer of that article, David Greenberg, The Hidden History of the Espionage Act and Slate, lays out for us, quote, "Overall, the act wasn't meant, as it has often been represented, to stifle anti-war dissent, but to address particular wartime problems that officials had good reason to worry about, draft avoidance, sabotage, and espionage." Now, Eugene Debs will ultimately sue on the basis of the First Amendment and take this all the way to the Supreme Court. But the initial arrest is in 1918, about a year after the implementation of the original Espionage Act. He's not a German, he's not an enemy combatant, a spy, or a saboteur. He's somebody who is giving a speech to fellow IWW and American Socialist Party members. Also, Eugene Debs is a socialist, a collectivist, the IWW very collectivistic, almost communistic. The IWW's motto, one big union. One big union. Despite all these efforts that continued well beyond the implementation of the Espionage Acts and even the Sedition Act during World War I, well, his ideas won. I would go as far to say that an even more radical and malignant version of his ideas won out in this country. And of course, I think I should make it clear that Eugene Debs, the American Socialist Party, and the industrial workers of the world, not the masterminds of some complex collectivist conspiracy, they were merely the symptoms. Here's G. Edward Griffin.
I think for analysis purposes, it's probably better just to look at all of these people as collectivists. They all have a common ideology of collectivism, and that is, of course, that the state should be all-powerful, that the people should obey the state, and they should serve the state for the greater good of the greater number. That's the common ideology to all of these philosophies, all of these ideologies. It's just the opposite of how we started here in the States. It was the other way around, that the people created the government. The government was to serve the people and protect the people. But over the years, that has been turned around, and now it's the people serving the government. The answer that will determine the future, whether or not freedom survives. Because if the people don't pick themselves up, so to speak, it's not going to happen. Because right now, the major channels of communication and leadership are pretty well dominated by collectivists. The kind of people who want to keep the masses in this sort of a stupor. Because I think it's necessary to point out that not all collectivists think of themselves as evil people. In fact, probably very few of them do. They think of themselves as doing what is right for mankind. They honestly believe that someone has to rule, someone has to make these hard decisions, and the people are too damn dumb, they think, to make decisions on their own. As long as these types of people are in control of the media and the educational system and so forth, you cannot ever hope that the average person is going to get the truth. He's going to continue to be propagandized. He's going to continue to be molded. His opinion is going to be engineered. And that's what you're witnessing, is that people turn off when they hear the truth because their opinion has been engineered by all of this media and educational system to look at that as some kind of a kooky, very bad point of view.
Wasn't it Lenin who called them the useful idiots as well, that they went along?
I think that might have been Stalin. Yeah, the useful idiots, the idealistic ones that promote communism or socialism. Or in Germany, they promoted fascism and Nazism, but they were all useful idiots because they really believed in all of this and they helped overthrow the existing order. And then once the new regime came to power, the first thing they did was to get rid of all those useful idiots that helped them to power. They round them up and shot them because they knew that once they discovered that they'd made a huge mistake, they would be in the vanguard of opposition to the new regime as well.
Fears that the European Union is on its way to becoming another Soviet Union. How real is this danger in America right now? The similarities with the system, where things were heading. Can we make a comparison how things were pre-revolution in Russia and what's happening in America right now?
Oh, yes. I think there's a very strong parallel. And I like the observation that the European Union is rapidly developing into like a Soviet. It's the same system. It's actually a structure of collectivism because that's what you need. You need to break down society into units and subunits with very rigid control from the top down and call it a Soviet if you wish or call it some other grouping. It doesn't make any difference. Here in the United States, the activity is going on right now to establish local people's units, people's representatives, right down at the community level. And the idea is to get everybody into this structure as tightly as possible and to give it the aura of springing from the will of the people, because the people cannot resist the people. They can get angry at the government, but if they think that the government really is the people, whether it is or not, if they think it is, then they're stupefied. They think, well, who am I going to get mad at? Myself? My neighbors? Then that's the reason they do that. They go to great lengths to create this image of this collectivist system somehow representing the people, and that the people are the force behind it, when in reality, the people have no control whatsoever. It's all from the top down.
This is really internationalism. The communists always talked about a world socialist state. This is also then when we enter in the realm of globalism, or, if you will, a new world order. So how close are these? If we take the old ideology of internationalism from coming from the communist socialist world and into the new era, what we hear about all the time in terms of the new world order, how similar are these, do you think?
Well, they're totally similar. Well, maybe not totally. 1% difference, and that's the concept of who will dominate it. The Nazis had the idea of global control, and it would have been a Nazi regime. The communists had one of global control. That's where the word internationalism first really became into play. They had the Communist International and so forth. And again, that was described as international socialism. By the time Cecil Rhodes came along and created his organization, originally it was to be dominated by Great Britain, but that was soon abandoned, and they decided to make it internationalism. By the time that came along, they realized it was necessary to eliminate the old stigmas of Nazism or communism and just call it internationalism and create the image of this was an amalgam of all the nations of the world with no emphasis on ideology. However, the ideology was just as strong as ever, but now they were talking about nations coming together and brotherhood and solving health problems and feeding the hungry, and that became the propaganda focus. The ideology was seldom discussed, but when you look at it, the ideology was exactly the same as it was under the German Hitler Mussolini combine and under Russia's communism. So yeah, the parallels are so strong, and the only difference really is that 1% veneer on the top, which is what you see when you look. If you don't look beneath the surface, what you see is something quite different, but it's really quite the same underneath. Under collectivism, some body of rulers will decide what is best in every area of life. They will decide what is best internationally. They'll decide what is best nationally at the state, local level. They'll decide what is best for you to think, what is best for you to wear, what is best for you to take on as employment, what is best for you to eat, everything. They'll make these decisions, and that's what, of course, is going on at the UN right now. There are a couple of billion pages literally produced by the UN every year, and all of those pages have to do with rules and regulations and guidelines for controlling people's lives, and even standards for garbage collection. That's the nature of collectivism. Everybody will follow the rules, and if you step out of line, of course, then you have to be punished. That's the nature of collectivism.
So as a communist revolution gets underway in Russia, here in the United States, people, a couple of people come to mind anyway, who ironically have a political, social ideology eerily similar to that of the president of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, find themselves being arrested, tried, and convicted under the Espionage Act. Eugene Debs, I mentioned. Before Debs' arrest, there was another man named Charles Schenck, S-C-H-E-N-C-K, who was convicted for violating the Espionage Act. He was the general secretary of the Socialist Party, and he was indicted for mailing anti-draft literature to about 15,000 people in Pennsylvania. Both Schenck and Debs worked their cases all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, citing the First Amendment, that the Espionage Act was unconstitutional. One Supreme Court justice who became famous, I would say, during these proceedings was Oliver Wendell Holmes. He was an associate justice. In both cases, I believe, he speaks for the majority. I would now like to read a pretty lengthy selection from a tremendously influential book on me anyway, Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States. This is from Chapter 14, War is the Health of the State. Congress passed, and Wilson signed in June of 1917, the Espionage Act. From its title, one would suppose it was an act against spying.
However, it had a clause that provided penalties up to 20 years in prison for, quote, whoever, when the United States is at war, shall willingly cause or attempt to cause insubordination, disloyalty, mutiny, or refusal of duty in the military or naval forces of the United States, or shall willfully obstruct the recruiting or enlistment service of the United States. Unless one had a theory about the nature of governments, it was not clear how the Espionage Act would be used. It even had a clause that said, quote, nothing in this section shall be construed to limit or restrict any discussion, comment, or criticism of the acts or policies of the government, unquote. But its double talk concealed a singleness of purpose: to imprison Americans who spoke or wrote against the war. 2 months after the law passed, a socialist named Charles Schenck was arrested in Philadelphia for printing and distributing 15,000 leaflets that denounced the draft law in the war. The leaflet recited the 13th Amendment provision against involuntary servitude and said that the Conscription Act violated this. Conscription, it said, was a monstrous deed against humanity in the interest of the financiers of Wall Street, and do not submit to intimidation. Schenck was indicted, tried, and found guilty, and sentenced to 6 months in jail for violating the Espionage Act. It turned out to be one of the shortest sentences given in such cases. Schenck appealed, arguing that the act, by prosecuting speech and writing, violated the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. The Supreme Court's decision was unanimous and was written by its most famous liberal, Oliver Wendell Holmes. He summarized the contents of the leaflet and said it was undoubtedly intended to obstruct the carrying out of the draft law. Was Schenck protected by the First Amendment? Holmes said, the most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater in causing panic. The question in every case is whether the words are used in such circumstances that are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent. Holmes' analogy was clever and attractive. Few people would think free speech should be conferred on someone shouting fire in a theater and causing panic. But did that example fit criticism of the war? Zachariah Chafee, a Harvard Law School professor, wrote later in Free Speech in the United States that a more apt analogy for Schenck was someone getting up between the acts at a theater and declaring that there were not enough fire exits. To play further with the example, was not Schenck's act more like someone shouting, not falsely but truly, to people about to buy tickets and enter a theater, that there was a fire raging inside? Perhaps free speech could not be tolerated by any reasonable person if it constituted a clear and present danger to life and liberty. After all, free speech must compete with other vital rights. But was not the war itself a clear and present danger? Indeed, more clear and more present and more dangerous to life than any argument against it? Did citizens not have a right to object to war? A right to be a danger to dangerous policies? The Espionage Act, thus approved by the Supreme Court, has remained on the books all these years since World War I, and although it is supposed to only apply in wartime, it has been constantly in force since 1950, because the United States has legally been in a state of emergency since the Korean War. In 1963, the Kennedy administration pushed a bill, unsuccessfully, to apply the Espionage Act to statements uttered by Americans abroad. It was concerned, in the words of a cable from the Secretary of State Rusk to Ambassador Lodge in Vietnam, about the journalists in Vietnam writing, quote, critical articles on Diem and his government that were likely to, quote, impede the war effort. The case of Eugene Debs soon came before the Supreme Court. In June of 1918, Debs visited three socialists who were in prison for opposing the draft, and then spoke across the street from the jail to an audience he kept enthralled for 2 hours. He was one of the country's great orators and was interrupted again and again by laughter and applause. Here's a quote. They tell us that we live in a great free republic, that our institutions are democratic, that we are a tree and self-governing people. That is too much, even for a joke. Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder. And that is war in a nutshell. The master class has always declared the wars. The subject class has always fought the battles. Debs was arrested for violating the Espionage Act. There were draft-age youths in his audience, and his words would, quote, obstruct the recruiting or enlistment service, unquote. His words were intended to do much more than that. Here's Debs again. Yes, in good time, we are going to sweep into power in this nation and throughout the world. We are going to destroy all enslaving, evil, degrading capitalist institutions and recreate them as free and humanizing institutions. The world is daily changing before our eyes. The sun of capitalism is setting. The sun of socialism is rising. Amen. As far as what was happening. In due time, the hour will strike and this great cause triumphant will proclaim the emancipation of the working class and the brotherhood of all mankind. Thunderous and prolonged applause. Debs refused at his trial to take the stand in his defense or to call witness on his behalf. He denied nothing about what he said. But before the jury began its deliberations, he spoke to them. Quote, I have been accused of obstructing the war. I admit it. Gentlemen, I abhor war. I would oppose war if I stood alone. I have sympathy with the suffering, struggling people everywhere. It does not make any difference under what flag they were born or where they live. The jury found him guilty of violating the Espionage Act. Debs addressing the judge before sentencing, quote, Your Honor, years ago I recognized my kinship with all living beings, and I made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on earth. I then said, and I say now, that while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. While there is a soul in prison, I am not free, unquote. The judge denounced those who would strike the sword from the hand of this nation while she is engaged in defending herself against a foreign and brutal power. He sentenced Debs to 10 years in prison. Debs' appeal was not heard by the Supreme Court until 1919. The war was over. Oliver Wendell Holmes, for a unanimous court, affirmed Debs' guilt. Holmes discussed Debs' speech, quote, He then expressed opposition to the Prussian militarism in a way that naturally might have been thought to be intended to include the mode of proceeding in the United States. Holmes said Debs, quote, made the usual contrast between capitalists and laboring men, with the implication running through it all that the working men are not concerned in the war. Thus, Holmes said, quote, The natural and intended effect of Debs' speech would be to obstruct recruiting. Debs was locked up in the West Virginia State Penitentiary, then in the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, where he spent 32 months until, at the age of 66, he was released by President Harding in 1921. About 900 people went to prison under the Espionage Act. This substantial opposition was put out of sight, while the visible national mood was represented by military bands, flag waving, and mass buying of war bonds, the majority's acquiescence to the draft and the war. This acquiescence was achieved by shrewd public relations and by intimidation, an effort organized with the power of the federal government and the money of big business behind it. The magnitude of that campaign to discourage opposition says something about the spontaneous feelings of the population toward the war. So now let's leave America in 1919 for Russia and check in on the progress that another group of collectivists are making.
When the Russian Empire was overthrown in 1917 during the October Revolution led by Vladimir Lenin, the population of the new Soviet Union had much anticipation for great change. Lenin built a communist government with many Bolshevik comrades. In this new regime, Stalin was soon introduced as an organizer. He was known to be very strong to enforce the new communist regime and soon climbed up the ladder to be elected as General Secretary in 1922. Lenin died in 1924 of a third stroke and left behind a struggle for power. Two members then began their fight, Joseph Stalin and Leon Trotsky. In his will, Lenin leaves an important warning concerning Stalin. Having become General Secretary, he has enormous power in his hands, and I'm not sure he always knows how to use that power at sufficient caution. Trotsky was known to have very radical ideas that seemed to make the general public uncomfortable, whereas Stalin was creating a great image supporting all of Lenin's beliefs. By ignoring Lenin's warning signs, the population chooses what they believe to be the lesser of two evils. The fight for power ends in a public humiliation of Trotsky while he's being exiled. This becomes a new chapter of Soviet lifestyle. Stalin holds the entire country in his hands and chooses to adopt a one-man dictatorship. By the end of the 1920s, his fight for ultimate power is complete, and it's in 1927 that Stalin introduces his first five-year plan of massive industrialization. All peasant land was to become state land, and all farmers became workers under the new collectivization. Everything they owned now belonged to the state, and they would have to work hard to produce enough food for the state to export in order to build this new industrial superpower. When peasants and farmers opposed to collectivization, they would be robbed of their belongings, trapped in their villages, and starved to death, or sent to the gulags, the Russian labor camps. The gulags were always situated in the harshest climates, and workers were forced slaves that worked to death. About 14 million people passed through the gulags. Many of them did not survive the harsh weather and physical or mental torture. If they were not sent to the gulags, they would die of starvation, working to feed other nations and not themselves. During that same time, Stalin bans the Russian Orthodox churches. All memorabilia depicting religion was ordered to be destroyed. He began to censor the images of Christ and anything that was related. He replaced the idea of God with himself. Households were forced to carry images of him as their great leader, the only leader they would need. He was to become the leader that the population would look up to. Stalin was excellent at reinforcing his image of the great leader, the miracle. Although over 5 million people were dying of starvation and millions more found themselves working till death in the gulags, they still cherished him and prayed to him, waiting to be saved. But in 1934, his power was threatened. Sergei Kirov was a Bolshevik leader during the October Revolution and rose to become head of the party organization in Leningrad. He charmed the nation with his strong Russian background and balanced beliefs. He gets elected to the Central Committee of the Party Congress of the Victorian. A large part of the population were hoping that he would become a leader of their great nation. The Congress voted 300-1 for Kirov to be in power. Stalin felt the threat and sent an assassin to shoot him. He died in 1934. At that moment, the purges began. A purge is defined as the removal of people who are considered undesirable by those in power from a government, from another organization, or from a society as a whole. In this case, government meant Stalin. Because Stalin didn't know who voted against him, he had most of the delegates of the 17th Congress shot. If they were not shot, they were sent to the gulags or arrested under the pretext that they were spies or enemy of the state. His constant paranoia led to the arresting and extermination of many Russians. The secret police were sent to sweep the streets and arrest anyone under any accusation. Stalin would sign death warrants every single day and night. This caused huge paranoia amongst the entire population. Everyone was fending for themselves, scared of their neighbors, scared to be denounced and arrested. As a result, the censorship of many photographs, films, books, art, anything that would unveil his horrible true self, were to be practiced during his reign. To avoid remembering important figures, Stalin had a group of government workers responsible to manipulate photographs. This censorship can be found today through many books and archives, and they can help explain Russia's history under Stalin's communist leadership.
In the 1920s, the U.S. government would use the intelligence and policing apparatus, ostensibly developed during World War I to deal with German spies, to counter the new perceived communist threat in the United States. But in the early 1920s, as the Woodrow Wilson administration drew to a close, it could be argued that the United States had already gone too far. All of the aspects and institutions that American schoolchildren were taught to fear, hate about the Soviet system in the 1920s, again in the 50s, in the 60s, even right into the 80s, had an eerily similar counterpart in the United States. Counterparts which, in many cases, had existed since the 19-teens.
To avoid remembering important figures, Stalin had a group of government workers responsible to manipulate photographs. This censorship can be found today through many books and archives, and they can help explain Russia's history under Stalin's communist leadership.
Hold in your mind, if you will, the phrase to avoid remembering important figures. Just for a couple minutes here. About a month or two before the passage of the Espionage Act in 1917, Woodrow Wilson, or at the very least his office, issued Executive Order 2594, establishing something called the Committee on Public Information. It was chaired by a man named George Creel, but also included the Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, Secretary of War, Newton Baker, and Secretary of the Navy, Josephus Daniels. It's also worth noting here that Robert Lansing was often regarded in the administration and Washington, D.C. generally at this time as a puppet of Edward Mendel House. Advising this committee was Edward Bernays, the father of public relations, who also was instrumental in helping the Wilson administration sell the war to the American public. And that was exactly the purpose of this committee, to propagandize the American public, who at the time was quite xenophobic and isolationist, and certainly would be again after this experience, into supporting the U.S. involvement in the war. There's a useful synopsis on the website AuthenticHistory.com. George Creel was, by all accounts, a man of two faces. In private, he was personable, funny, and gregarious, one of the best storytellers of his day, a truly likable personality. In public, however, Creel was something of a berserker. His public speeches were so bellicose and bitter that once he was said to have been shocked to read in the newspaper the next day what he had said. Too outspoken and tactless, even his critics had to admit that Creel had energy and imagination. Although Congress authorized a budget of $1.25 million, Creel was heavily subsidized by the chief executive's President's Fund. With near limitless cash at his disposal, Creel soon cranked up a massive propaganda machine. Since the Great War took place before the advent of electronic mass media, which started with radio only a few years after the war, Creel relied heavily on visual forms of media. Posters were especially effective. An army of artists rallied to the colors, as Creel put it, and were put to work under the division of pictorial publicity. Artists such as James Montgomery Flagg, Charles Dana Gibson, Harrison Fisher, and Joseph Pennell churned out patriotic works that even today are artistically stunning. Flag's iconic Uncle Sam, I Want You poster remains today one of the most recognized patriotic images in America. Although the country had just absorbed some 13 million immigrants during the previous two decades, Creel's campaign was calculated to reach anyone who could understand a picture. And they were everywhere, on billboards, the walls of subway stations, the sides of barns, anywhere an American might travel. Creel referred to his ad campaign as the Battle of the Fences. Creel also made effective use of the presses. Millions of pro-war, pro-Wilson leaflets, pamphlets, and propaganda booklets found their way into American homes, often written by historians and college professors. Creel's use of visuals extended to the photographic media. He organized a motion picture division and created propaganda films with titles like Pershing's Crusaders, America's Answer, and Under Four Flags. Hollywood took up the cause and was soon producing its own propaganda, and some of the biggest stars of the silent era promoted the Liberty Loan drives at huge public rallies. Now, in the midst of all this blind nationalism that the Creel Committee is drumming up with all these different campaigns, a film is made that catches the committee's attention. And unfortunately for the filmmaker, I think, from everything I can find out, it was just part of the patriotic fervor. The film was called The Spirit of 76, and it was about the American Revolution, a topic that the average, maybe somewhat naive, public school graduate would think would inspire patriotism and remind us about the values that we as Americans are supposed to hold so dear. Independence, individuality, liberty, right? America. But for some reason, the Creel Committee wanted it censored. From the book Freedom of the Press, Rights and Liberties Under the Law by Nancy C. Cornwall, page 85. Over 2,000 political dissenters faced prosecution under the Espionage Act of 1917. Among them were people like filmmaker Robert Goldstein, who went to prison because the court believed that his motion picture, The Spirit of 76, which depicted the American Revolution and some of the atrocities committed by the British, might, quote, question the good faith of our World War I ally, Great Britain, unquote, and cause insubordination, a violation of the Espionage Act. There's also a footnote in the book Language, Symbols, and Media, Communication in the Aftermath of 9/11, that reads, the Creel Committee's attempt to shut down a movie that contained a brutal scene involving the bayoneting of a baby by a British soldier resulted in Supreme Court case United States versus motion picture film The Spirit of 76, 1917. The government argued that the producer of the film had violated sections 1 and 3 of the Espionage Act by attempting to, quote, cause insubordination in the army. He was sentenced to 10 years in jail and fined $5,000. 2 years later, it was upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court. Imagine the chilling effect these decisions must have had on the motion picture industry in its infancy. End footnote. Now, we could say, well, that's simply the abuse of power by some unaccountable government, department, or committee. The Creel Committee pulls the Espionage Act into an arena where it doesn't belong. You could also say, oh, that's mission creep. The Espionage Act out of control, overextended, being used for things that it was not originally intended for. Keep in mind that at this point, where the Spirit of 76 comes under fire, the Sedition Act, which actually censors quote-unquote subversive speech, doesn't exist. But maybe it wasn't either of those things. Maybe it was a combination of a little bit of both those things, but also something else. And it's this. What is the Spirit of 76? Without feigning some kind of nostalgia for the Founding Fathers, or sounding like I'm hosting a program on InfoWars.com, what ideas, what concepts do you think the spirit of 76 represents? Individual liberty? Individuality, period? Self-determination? Free thought? Free press? Freedom from oppressive controls? Well, perhaps the Creel Committee and the courts were right to strike down the spirit of 76. Because in America, during World War I, under the administration of Woodrow Wilson and the imperialist government, it didn't really seem like a safe time or place for those ideas. To be continued.